This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Protesters forced a halt to a special session of the North Carolina General Assembly this morning.
What do you do?
Stand up like that!
When education is under attack, what do you do?
Stand up like that!
Listen up! Listen up! I need your attention! I need your attention! I'm Chief Brock, General Assembly Police. You are causing a disruption to the North Carolina General Assembly. The House is in session. I have asked you to lower your voices. If you do not, I'm going to place you under arrest.
Debate resumed today after protesters were removed, state legislators making a last-minute push to slash the power of incoming Governor Roy Cooper. It has provoked strong demonstrations that began last night. Protesters arrested again today. At least 20 protesters were arrested last night as hundreds gathered at the Capitol to speak out against the Republican power grab. WUNC Capitol Bureau Chief Jeff DeBeery joins me now from the Capitol. Welcome back, Jeff.
Hello, Frank.
Also with us, political junkie Ken Rudin. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Frank.
Jeff, what's the latest down there?
The protests continue at this hour, and I would estimate 12 to 15 arrests so far today. We saw this yesterday in the House and Senate. Today in the House, likely to see it later today in the Senate. There's a gallery in these legislative bodies upstairs where anybody can go. I mean, any member of the public can go and observe the proceedings. There were not vocal disruptions, as I understand it, initially from within the gallery. They were from outside, but the speaker asked the sergeant-at-arms, the Capitol Police, to clear the gallery, which is what they did yesterday. They moved people out into the rotunda. The chants continued, and as you just heard, members of the General Assembly Police asked folks to quiet down. They didn't initially. There were a series of arrests, asked them to quiet down again. They did. They started chanting very softly. And then in time, the voices again were raised, and one by one, arrests have been made. They're protesting, as you mentioned, some very significant legislation that has been introduced and moved through in less than 48 hours.
Yeah, let's talk about that legislation that provoked this growing protest here in the state of North Carolina and growing alarm across the country. We'll talk to Ken Rudin about that in a minute, but let's talk about what provoked this protest and what legislation has already passed. Where are we in this effort to reduce the power of Governor-elect Roy Cooper?
Two main bills in this fourth special session. Initially, remember, lawmakers came back to deal with disaster relief stemming from hurricane flooding victims and wildfires in the western portion of the state. Then they reconvened an unscheduled fourth special session. A slew of bills were filed. Much of that, I think, just points to the chaos and the lack of communication and understanding within the General Assembly, within the Republican caucus. But there are two bills of focus now. One is called Senate Bill 4. The other is House Bill 17. We'll start with Senate Bill 4. That has moved through the Senate and through the House, if I'm remembering it correctly. Yes, just moved through the House within the last few minutes. This is a bill that is more specifically titled the Elections, Ethics, and Court Reform Bill. What this does is it does away with the five-member State Board of Elections. That's a board that is of some significance for certain that the governor has appointment power over. It's a 3-2 split, correlating with whichever party is holding the executive mansion. So Senate Bill 4 does away with that. It gives an increase in authority and power to the appellate court here in the state. And we should note that the Supreme Court in North Carolina, as of January, will be a 4-3 Democratic split. But the appellate court is a 15-judge body, and there are a majority of Republicans. So those are among the top-line takeaways from Senate Bill 4. But the short of it, to your point, Frank, is this deals with separation of powers and executive authority, and it really takes away some of the punch that the governor can pack, the role of the governor. So that's Senate Bill 14. House Bill 17 is a bill that deals with appointments and also employment. So under Beverly Perdue, going back briefly here, just 8 years ago, when Beverly Perdue took office, she had 500 staff positions in 2008 for her entire administration. The Republican government, the government of small, grew that to 1,500 positions under the McCrory administration, and now they're going to roll that back under this proposal to 300 administration positions under Governor-elect Cooper. So that's kind of the broader picture. But in terms of the appointments, this would take away some appointments to the university system. This, again, House Bill 17. And perhaps of the most significance, depending on who you talk to, but it's certainly significant, any cabinet appointments that the governor would make must have Senate confirmation. And what that would do is deter some folks from wanting to serve as a cabinet secretary under the governor, because you'd have to go through a confirmation process. I mean, that could get ugly, that could get personal. And it also gives the General Assembly power to say, hey, you know, this is who Governor-elect Cooper wants to run the environmental component of things. Well, this person's too liberal, or, yeah, you know, we don't have a good vibe on this person, so they would reject them. Sorry to be so long-winded.
No, but it's good, because we need this explanation. Two bills are going to have to cross over. They're going to have to be approved by both houses. Is there any sense in the world that there's any opposition to these? Are these guys going to ram it through?
I mean, there's Democratic opposition, but again, right, Republicans have supermajorities in both chambers here. One interesting note, I talked to a staff member of a highly ranking House member last night, and I said, how have the conversations gone with the governor pertaining to this? Because that's the weird ironic twist, right? Some of this stuff most likely in the next few hours is going to go to lame duck Republican Governor Pat McCrory. And what I was told was some of those conversations have gone really well and some of them have gone terribly. We'll see how the governor handles this.
Ken Rudin, let's talk about this from a national perspective. You've got the New York Times calling this a brazen power grab. They're not the first to notice what's going on here. You've got the governor of the state refusing to acknowledge defeat, holding things up, at the very least proving there was no voter fraud in the month that he took to finally acknowledge defeat. And in the aftermath of that, we see this. How unusual is this kind of behavior nationally?
Well, I think there have been little instances. I think if you talk about sometimes the legislature overstepping its bounds, an outgoing governor trying to make some pardons or appointments or vetoes. We've seen that in the past, but when you see them all tied together, what's going on in North Carolina from the moment that they had the first special session that put through HB2, and you now know that whenever the General Assembly is going to have a special session, you know that something is no good. But the fact that they're all put together the way they are is giving North Carolina a very unfavorable, shall we say, view from the rest of the country. Watching power grab seems to be the right point. And what Jeff didn't mention, although Jeff was so complete with it, with his report, but there doesn't seem to be anything illegal or unconstitutional what the Republicans are doing. Yes, the Democrats will vote against it, but it seems like they're not doing anything illegally, which is even maybe more frightening. I've seen instances in the past where the legislature has tried to pull some fast ones over the people. I've seen protesters being thrown out of the galleries when they're watching sessions going on in the state house or senate or even Congress. But the fact that they all coming together, all of them are happening, between the governor pushing for a recount, of refusing to concede for a month, and now basically the legislature almost trying to undo what happened on November 8th, really seems to be pretty much unprecedented.
In a special session with no deliberation and no consideration, and that, of course, Jeff, speaks to what the Republicans are saying. They obviously can't acknowledge what is transparent, that this is a power grab, so they have to say something. And what they say is, look, this is a long time coming. This has just been a power imbalance, and we're going to address it here. That's part of what they're saying.
That's absolutely the case of what they're saying. And you're right. I did not note that a moment ago. It appears at first glance that much of what they're doing is within their constitutional authority, requiring cabinet secretaries to seek approval from the state Senate and moving some of this authority back to the legislature. Democrats have protested and they're saying, you know, they're cutting out the people. They're cutting out, you know, the vetting process, the committee process, the due process, really taking a step back and, looking at how consolidating various parts of government and moving these powers from executive to the legislative branch will have an effect. So one thing that has been said to me is that the appellate court enhancement, I guess, is maybe the best word for it at this point. That is an area that a couple of legal folks have told me is ripe for a challenge because there's some question about whether or not it circumvents the state Supreme Court and thus isn't in line with due process. So you will see challenges. But to Ken's point, some of this stuff is within the state constitution, and I would expect some of it to hold.
Yeah, and but to the point that they're addressing a power imbalance that's been around for years. Of course, the retort to that is, well, you've had 4 years under a Republican governor to fix that. Why did you call a special session in which you will deliberate not at all to make these monumental changes? And to that point, Ken, this is obviously cynical politics, and it's the kind of thing that registers with people. I mean, what's the impact on an electorate to make these kind of cynical arguments when you say, well, we've decided today to address something we've ignored for 4 years? We know what you're talking about. What's the impact on the electorate here? And then again, outside the country, abroad in a country that is already resisting and moving away from the state of North Carolina because of HB2?
Well, I think there are two obvious reactions and likely reactions. Either there's tremendous outrage, as Jeff has pointed out, as we've seen in the House and Senate galleries, or there's just a numbness. And I suspect that since the election was only 5 weeks ago, it seems like forever, but it's only 5 weeks ago, I think the outrage continues. And the fact is that, you know, not only is North Carolina getting national attention for what's going on here, but you're looking at what's going on with the Trump administration and the Trump cabinet. And now, I mean, talking about trying to change the rules in the middle of the game, in a sense that some Democrats are trying to do the same thing with the Electoral College. There's some members of Congress who are talking about delaying the next Monday. It's next Monday already. The vote of the Electoral College, saying that they need to be told get intelligence reports of alleged Russian interference in the election before they vote. And of course, you know, there's never been a case of delaying the Electoral College for that. But there's a lot of frustration. There's an outrage going on. And again, as Jeff just said, I mean, I don't know what they could do about it in North Carolina. I don't know what they could do about it in Washington, D.C. either. It just seems like the General Assembly will have its way in North Carolina.
Well, we'll talk about the impact. I'm going to take a break here and talk about the impact and the way North Carolina might mirror the rest of the country. Ken Rudin's with me, Jeff DeBerry on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Protests disrupt the General Assembly today as they try to take power from the incumbent, or I should say the governor-elect Roy Cooper. Those debates were suspended while protesters were removed again today. Some arrests were made, and we're talking about it today on the State of Things with Jeff DeBerry, our Capitol Bureau chief, and political junkie Ken Rudin. Jeff, let's talk about a man who is arguably the most powerful man in the state of North Carolina, Phil Berger, the senator who runs the Senate. And he's a guy who's run the Senate and pretty much the state with an iron hand, sometimes to the dismay of Pat McCrory, who found himself following along whether he liked it or not. Talk about Phil Berger and how he's perceived among his colleagues there, because he runs things with a pretty tight fist, doesn't he?
Sure. This is a lawmaker who is in the minority for a number of years. And, you know, his right-hand man and the person that people around here and people within political circles talk about is Jim Blaine. And they credit him as being the architect for much of the very conservative agenda, the conservative ideologies and social proposals and fiscal proposals that have moved through this body in recent years. Let's remember that Republicans took over the General Assembly in 2010 for the first time since Reconstruction, added supermajorities in 2012, meaning what we talked about before, legislature already has more power than the executive. They've been able to really push through whatever they want. And Phil Berger is somebody who is not a loud or an in-your-face personality. He's pretty steady. But he's made no apologies at any point about, the kinds of laws that this body has enacted. I mean, he says that this is what, you know, is good for the economy, is good for the people of North Carolina. It is good for his constituents. And, you know, we've seen a number of laws come out of the General Assembly in the last 4 years that have been struck down in federal court. And it's certainly an interesting time, a very divisive time here in North Carolina. And he's the figurehead.
Well,
in
those
many
laws,
ways,
Jeff, just,
this,
to, just yeah. to point this out, are racially discriminatory. And that brings me to another point, Ken, which is how North Carolina under Phil Berger really represents what we're seeing nationally. Phil Berger comes from an area of the state which is economically distressed. He's coming from a place that is losing jobs, not gaining jobs. You're looking that in contrast to the more progressive urban areas in the state that are generating enormous economic progress and making this, on paper, you know, one of the most economically progressive states in the country. But that's because of the progressive urban areas. The place Phil Berger represents is losing jobs. It's economically distressed. Also, historically, a Ku Klux Klan stronghold with strong racial tensions. And to that, so Ken, I want to ask you about this, because here's a guy who's not been able to bring jobs to his district, but has been able to promote this kind of work on racial tensions, two important laws that the courts have struck down as racially discriminatory. How does that mirror what we're seeing now, and particularly with the Trump victory?
Well, I mean, a lot of people will attest, will make the argument that Trump was elected because of job security, the lack of jobs, the fact that jobs are being shifted overseas, the fact that many jobs that were created at least in the 8 years of the Obama administration did not go to the white middle class or white poor class in the industrial Midwest, the Ohios, the Pennsylvanias, the Michigan, the Wisconsins. But what Phil Berger is doing also is also mirrored in by a lot of states also about voting rights. And we've seen this happening around the country, probably more visible than North Carolina, because that from the beginning we knew that North Carolina would be ground zero for 2016. But there are other states that are just cutting back on voting hours, about ability to vote, about absentee voting, about early voting, making it tougher to register to vote. And, of course, these are states run by Republicans, and it's been going on around the country. Well, quick question I'd love to ask Jeff is that we're talking about that the Democrats may not have any recourse to deal with this, but there are special elections for the legislature
Correct.
Coming up in 2017 because of redistricting. I wonder if the outrage in the state would be so much and the lines would be completely redrawn, if indeed they are, that some change could be made in the legislature in 2017.
It's a fascinating question. I had an exchange with a political scientist this week. His name is Chris Cooper, no relation to the governor-elect. And he said to me, this is from an email I'm reading here, but he said, the real question is whether the public sees this as just politics or as a naked power grab that crosses the ethical line. If the recent past is any guide, partisanship will ultimately provide the lens that makes Democrats see it as the latter and Republican voters see it as the former. And if that's the case, then the electoral consequences of all this would be limited. And tying in with the conversation that we're having here, the districts here are gerrymandered. Anybody impartial can look at that. I mean, if you're being objective, districts here have been gerrymandered. A federal court has ruled that 28 of them are illegal racial gerrymanders, and that's why we're going to most likely have a 2017 special election that Ken just mentioned. That will likely affect about 115 to 120 General Assembly seats, and what hangs in the balance is the supermajority in the House. Republicans they have three seats of flexibility, meaning Democrats need to pick up three seats to end a supermajority in the House, and what that would do functionally from a policy standpoint is it would give a gubernatorial veto much more teeth. But what are we seeing right now in this moment? We're seeing some of the authority come away from the executive, and it's almost as though, in addition to what is obviously being classified as a power grab, Republicans are thinking ahead to what might transpire in the next 1, 2, 3, 4 elections.
I want to thank you both for being on the program. And of course, we'll be following the protests at the Capitol as the General Assembly continues in this special session. Jeff Tiberi is there, and I encourage you to listen to this public radio station for more. And I want to thank both of you, Ken Rudin, the political junkie, and Jeff Tiberi, WUNC Capitol Bureau Chief. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Frank.